Blog Talk Radio.
Can't tell if you guys can hear me. Welcome to Right from the Left Coast. Somebody type in if you can hear my voice. I don't know if the commercials are still playing, so don't have a sound check. Okay, great, Ron. Thanks. We got that. My name is Linda. This is Right from the Left Coast. Welcome, everyone. It is, we're in Oceanside. Beautiful, gorgeous skies today. I couldn't believe it. 72 degrees. We're supposed to have rain tomorrow. I'm praying we don't have rain tomorrow because I have to schlep my mom and everything to my niece's house. So it's going to be incredible. You guys are talking about food, and Thanksgiving is on the horizon, of course. Oh, God, you guys, you're making me crazy. Okay, keep talking about food. It's a lot of fun, I know. I know you guys are getting horrible weather, and it's like almost like Hawaii here. We're so fortunate. We are brought to us by PatriotFamilies.com, www.PatriotFamilies.com. And I'm happy to see Bill, Ron, Lonnie, and Yo in the chat room. They're just having a blast preparing for Thanksgiving. And I want to hope everyone has a great Thanksgiving this year. I know there's so many people that are, you know, going to be really, really sad around their tables because there are people missing. I know Miss Terry Rowland is going to be because tomorrow is her beloved's would have been birthday celebration. And then we have Jolene's mom, which is another sad thing. And, of course, Tom Golden, one of the people that used to just crack us up in the chat room. So all our prayers go to these people. We love you. We remember. We celebrate their lives and their legacy. So on with the show, and you guys can call in. I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the news I heard on the radio today and then get into a piece that was sent to me by my friend Pat Hitley. She's my lady that goes with me to practice at Ironsights when we target practice. It's really fun. And when she went with me last time, because she's making up her mind which type of handgun she wants to buy. And she tried a Glock, and then she got this really nice one, a 9mm Kimber. Oh, and I got to hold that and kind of mess around with it a little bit. I didn't shoot from it, but I want one of those. And of course, you know, beer income and champagne taste. I heard they're rather expensive. One of these days, I'll get one. Oh, Ron, that Kimber was like so sweet. I wanted to buy one the next day, but I know they're expensive. What I heard today on the radio just before we went live, it was a 9mm, that particular one. I know they make others. They make 45s and I'm sure everything else, too, under the sun. They're talking about guns now. I can't read them all so quickly. I guess the despot-in-chief, that's what we're going to call him now because he thinks he's a dictator, Ovamit decided to, I don't know how he did this, made some kind of a wave of a magic wand in his little despotic, you know, ivory tower. And now these people who came over on these visas from 37 different countries, he decided if they have family here, they can just stay. They don't have to go home, you know, from these 37 different countries. And what really gripes me the most is that nobody stops him. Absolutely nobody stops this man. Apparently they don't care. All they do is talk about it. They, you know, wag their fingers. They pretend. I'm tired of it. The Republicans, as we should call them, the Repubics, should go the way of the Whig Party. It's just unbelievable. So to get into this one piece, this was entitled Letters from the Gulag, Tyranny in America. For dummies. So let me go into this one. It's not real long, but we'll see what we got here. It says, dedicated to the truth teller, Congressman Dr. Larry McDonald, who was assassinated by a joint operation of the CIA and the KGB. Fact is, as hated as the John Birch Society was, they got it right. History has vindicated them in every respect. The history goes way back 1939, I think the original creation of the Emergency Powers Act. Fact, it saw several additions and strengthening over the years, and under the Clinton administration, it was drastically strengthened. I screamed, and no one cared. Fact, then there was the Kansas versus Hendricks SCOTUS precedent in June of 1997, allowing for the indefinite detention of a person ruled sane but a danger to society who had served out his sentence. SCOTUS ruled that for the public good, Kansas could hold him. There went the Bill of Rights. That is the precedent upon which all the so-called prophylactic laws are based. I screamed, nobody listened. Fact, then following 9/11, George Bush declared a state of national emergency, 9/14/2001, which effectively suspended the Constitution and a category of people who could be held prophylactically to include Islamic terrorists. Things appeared normal, but Bush kept renewing the state of emergency and handed it over to Obama. The national media was nearly totally silent about the real loss of liberty. After all, the Kansas case supposedly protected us from sexual predators, and now the state of emergency and the resultant Patriot Act was going to protect us from terrorists. But some people finally began to wake up. Fact, April 7, 2009, Homeland Security expanded the category of potential terrorists to include anyone holding conservative views, vis-a-vis gun control, abortion, Christian morals, nationalism, even veterans, etc. By now, millions were screaming in protest, but the government wasn't listening. The media ignored the story, and at least 90% of the American population remained oblivious to the fact that there had been a coup d'etat. And anyone who didn't like it was now classified as mentally ill, having a syndrome called oppositional defiance disorder. And as the link will show, people had already been incarcerated for this ailment. Of course, you can't do the link from there. But in fact, June of 2012, Obama changed the definition of those who could be arrested without charge, held indefinitely without right of habeas corpus to any deemed a threat to national security, which is the exact same power Joseph Stalin held in the old USSR, where he murdered upwards of 80 million people, not counting the military. Fact, the NDAA spring of 2012 canceled the Posse Comitatus Act, allowing for U.S. troops to be deployed for police action inside the U.S. It authorized domestic armed drones wiretap without warrant and gave Obama the power to kill any citizen deemed a threat to national security. Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Fact, June 28, 2012, a day that will live in infamy, the Roberts Court ruling on the Obama Health Care Act removed all constraints from the federal government via coercion, allowing for unlimited coercion via taxation. And there was a sign held up quoting Goethe, "None are more hopelessly enslaved than those who falsely believe that they are free." Boy, are we in that category. Fact, the Republic as we knew it, as most people still think it is over. Fact, under the Emergency Powers Act, the media has been reporting fake news for the last 12 years. I say it goes back further than that. The dystopian media, the same cabal, has taken control of both political parties and destroyed their true grassroots democratic process. If you attended the 2012 Republican convention, you know exactly what I'm talking about. So, fact, last season's political campaign was a kabuki play guaranteeing the election of a New World Order candidate, either Romney or Obama, and 2014 will be no different. There's a book that they show here. The face says, it's obviously a national bestseller, "The Revolt of the Elites and Betrayal of Democracy" by Christopher Lash. Apparently it came out, I'm not sure when it came out, let me see what it's got here. It says, fact, the cabal that has effected a coup d'etat was described by famous historian Christopher Lash 25 years ago in his book, "The Revolt of the Elites and the Betrayal of Democracy." It is the leadership classes, those who control the international flow of money and information, preside over philanthropic foundations and institutions of higher learning, manage the instruments of cultural production and thus set the terms of the public debate that have lost faith in the values of the American experiment and Western culture in general. In their self-reliance and overconfidence, our thinking classes have seceded not just from the common world around them, but from reality itself. A picture of Obama bowing to the Saudi sheikh or king. Time has taught us that the cabal is neocon Marxist Muslim. It places the United States in relation to Islam as a dhimmi nation, and we are moving very quickly to become a Marxist Sharia state. Any Muslim knows what the above bow of Obama before the Saudi king means. For the neocon part, you have to remember that the Brave New World Order went public and was announced in no uncertain terms by George H.W. Bush, and the actual suspension of constitutional liberties occurred under George W. Bush. Presidents Clinton and Obama and the two Bushes worked hand-in-hand to create this dystopia. In case you think this is a fantasy, remember Obama saying over and over again in the summer of 2012 that our war with terror was over. If it is over, why did he renew the state of national emergency in September of 2012? Why did he renew the state of national emergency in September of 2013? So here, okay, then they have all these clips, and I can't play them because it may not work. I don't want feedback. The list of Obama's constitutional abuses. Were the Constitution in effect and not voided, Obama would have been impeached by his first year in office. And it goes on to tell all of these, the executive privilege, fast and furious, 23 executive orders on gun control, infringement of the Second Amendment, executive order bypassing Congress on immigration, NDAA, but a violation of 3rd, 4th, 5th, 6th, and 7th Amendments, the NDRP, government, these are executive orders, government can seize anything. Another order gives Interpol jurisdiction on American soil by beyond law enforcement agencies, including the FBI. And it just there's just tons of them. I don't want to go through the whole thing. I'll try to get this to you guys by email or put it in the other chat rooms. So let's go back to, oh, man. Anyway, so they're still talking guns. Love it. Yeah, we're going to need them, guys. I think we're in for a whole world of hurt. And I can't remember who said it. Oh, I know who it was. It was yesterday on Glenn's show. It was – that's okay. You guys can call in too, but I just want to get through a couple items I didn't get to the last 2 or 3 weeks because we got so behind and we were so enthralled with all these things that were happening, throwing at us, the Agenda 21 stuff, the immigration, the Unaffordable Care Act. I mean, it's just – it's too much mind-boggling stuff. The guy's name is – he's one of the – heads of the Ayn Rand Center Institute, and his name is Yaron Brooks, and he basically was talking about not only the healthcare stuff, but when he talked to Glenn about the financial collapse, because Yaron is, of course, an Austrian school of economics proponent, of course, like Hayek and von Mises. Well, Glenn says, what does this look like with this collapse, you know, this imminent? And so Yaron says, nobody has a timeline on this because they just can't, you know, we can't do the crystal ball thing. We don't know when it's going to hit. And so then Glenn says, well, what do you think it actually looks like? And Yaron says, it's going to be totalitarianism. It is not going to be fun. So these are things we have to worry about. Now let's go back to the past because this is part of the creature comes to America, the creature from Jekyll Island. And this was something I wanted to get that Jefferson talked about. And then there's a few things I will get into after that because I want to go into what we're actually doing. We don't have the Austrian model. We have the Keynesian model, which I'm learning from Hillsdale College. Our wonderful professor there, Gary Wolfram, he's pretty good. He can explain it to people. He's, you know, he does the spoon feeding. He's very good. He's like Terry Rowland when it comes to explaining to people who don't get it. And I'm actually doing quite well in getting my hundreds and 8 out of 10s and, you know, stuff like that for the test because they have quizzes. So this is part of the book for The Creature from Jekyll Island. And it says, Thomas Jefferson pointed out that the Constitution did not grant to Congress the power to create a bank or anything similar. That means such power is reserved to the states or to the people. In a rebuttal to Hamilton's proposal, he said, to take a single step beyond the boundaries thus specially drawn around the powers of Congress is to take possession of a boundless field of power, no longer susceptible of any definition. Furthermore, he said, even if the Constitution had granted such power, it would be an extremely unwise thing to do, because allowing banks to create money could only lead to a national ruin. And it says, Hamilton, on the other hand, argued that debt was a good thing if kept within reason, and that the nation needed more money in circulation to keep up with expanding commerce. Only the bank, he said, would be able to provide that. Furthermore, while it is true the Constitution did not specifically grant the power to create such a bank, it was nevertheless an implied power. Oh, thank you, Hamilton, you little philosopher king, because it was needed to accomplish other functions which were granted in the Constitution. That was the end run. Nothing could be more polarized than the opposing ideas of those two men. So Jefferson, quote, a private central bank issuing the public currency is a greater menace to the liberties of the people than a standing army. We must not let our rulers load us with perpetual debt, end of quote. Then we have Hamilton, quote, no society could succeed which did not unite the interest and credit of rich individuals with those of the state. A national debt, if it is not excessive, will be to us a national blessing, end quote, of Hamilton. I have to disagree, as we see. What a mess. Now, the last, let's see, the next one, what this was, now this is talking about inflation, because that's what happens when they keep printing money. They got the QE infinity, which is nuts. So Jefferson was exclaiming, I wish it were possible to obtain a single amendment to our Constitution. I would be willing to depend on that alone for the reduction of the administration of our government to the general principle of the Constitution. I mean, an additional article taking from the federal government their power of borrowing. That's another good one that he talked about. Then they're talking about an instrument of plutocracy. So this is, they're going back to the Bank of the United States, of course, and it says the development of this plutocracy was well described by Governor Morris, the former delegate from New York, who had helped to draft the Constitution into its final form. He had been an assistant to Robert Morris, the two not related, and was a champion of the concept of a natural aristocracy. So he knew his subject well when he warned, the rich will strive to establish their dominion and enslave the rest. They always did and they always will. They will have the same effect here as elsewhere if we do not, by such a government, keep them within their proper spheres. We should remember that the people never act from reason alone. The rich will take advantage of their passions and make these the instruments for oppressing them. The result of the contest will be a violent aristocracy or a more violent despotism. Can't agree more with that. So now I wanted to go into, again, let me put up the, you guys know the number, 646-378-0321, and see if you wanted to comment on the letters from the Gulag and also from what I just read on Creature from Jekyll Island, what Jefferson was saying and actually what Hamilton was saying. So apparently we know where he stood on banks, and we had talked about that before. So what I was learning from all of this studies that I got from Hillsdale talking about Econ 101 this particular week was incentive and the information problem. And Gary talks about central planners are incapable of producing wealth for the masses. You think? The only system that can achieve the above goal is free market capitalism. Because, you know, when you deal with government does anything, they screw it up so badly. Look what's going on with Obamacare, and it will get 10,000 times worse. They need to repeal it. What you have in markets is an information problem and an incentive problem, and no one person or no board of elected or unelected Lilliputian bureaucrats can ever figure this out. What he goes on to say is consumers will demand things and producers will produce things if they have an incentive to do so. And in the Soviet Union, Russia had one-third of the world's resources and could not produce a box of cornflakes because there were no incentives for people to innovate or to produce. If everyone is paid the same, this is talking about the wage difference, and some do not work as hard as others, there is not much incentive to be proficient in your job, which is obviously true. So here we go. When he talks about the information problem, and he talks about the market system works to solve this problem, excess supply and demand. So the markets tend to move towards equilibrium, and that's the price, of course, and the quantity on a scale, and the demand is a downward slope, and the supply is usually an upward slope. And the equilibrium comes when the supply curve meets the demand curve on the price and quantity index. So then we go, the demands, the consumer demands change the price system. We have decentralized information. And so the hypothesis was, if you had a czar for breakfast, it would not be good. And they told all the markets and stores how much milk and coffee would be needed on any given day. That would not be good. Central planners cannot possibly know where the resources ought to be used. They don't know what consumer demand is in the first place. So then we go to central planning. This is central planning part two. What to do with oil? We have diesel, kerosene, gas, and plastic. If consumers value gas or plastic, the producers will want to outbid that producer of oil for that oil. Spontaneous order, meaning so that resources move toward their most valuable use. If the government can confiscate resources and say, you're going to work here or producers will work over here, so far government can't confiscate labor or steel or electricity. They're trying. Government does not know whether they are using resources that may be valued somewhere else than they are in whatever the government is making. So it talks about the government versus the free markets. So it says, let's say the government-run public schools, they can't even teach a fourth grader to read. A systematic problem, especially K through 12, which starts to look like central planning now. The product of government public schools absolutely sucks. Kids are then less productive because they will be in low-wage jobs, and that helps steer them into government dependency. Versus free market, let's say if you were having cell phones, there's videos, there's text, email, call, you can use games and apps. So this is how innovation works versus what they do with everything that they do. Okay, take care. Have a blessed Thanksgiving, yo, and get some rest. In a central plan system, the planner decides everything. And if we as people act accordingly to our own plan, it will not look like what the central planner has planned. Never does. So central planners have to force us to do what they want us to do, or the plan is not going to work. Like everyone has to drive electric cars, let's say. Electric cars are too expensive, too short a distance than you have to recharge the battery. They're too hard to dispose of the old batteries, too expensive to buy a new battery. Then no one will want to buy electric cars. If we don't buy them, then the plan won't work. All centrally planned states have an authoritarian type government. If we are free to act according to our own plan, then the central plan just won't work. And so then Gary talks about there is no political freedom without economic freedom. These two go together. How do you have freedom of speech if government owns all the press? Well, there you go. How do you assemble if the government owns all the land? Agenda 21. All our Bill of Rights are a direct reflection of property rights. We must have the right to own property. central state that does not allow us to act according to our own plan will always result in an authoritarian government. That's correct. Some places have high economic freedom, but no political freedom, such as Hong Kong. But if you cannot have political freedom, you cannot have political freedom unless you have economic freedom. Governments at times want to infringe upon our property rights. You think? Because property rights are essential to individual freedom, and we can act on our own behalf. We need a free market system to protect our liberties and our rights to property. That's very true. Okay, some can't plan. Okay, some central planning systems can run for a long periods of time, like the feudal system, and like a monastery. But we don't want to live like the 13th century monks. In 13th century France, you would be focused on finding enough food to eat, not granite countertops for your kitchen or those types of amenities. Over time, you move from the feudal system to mercantilism and then to market capitalism, which creates innovation. Today, if we look at countries with central planning like North Korea, as opposed to free market capitalism, we see a vast difference in the wealth of these countries. What does it look like to be poor in America? Here we go. 80% of poor people have air conditioning. 75% of people in America who are poor have a car. 42% of all poor people own their own home. And we go to 8. We have much more living space than the average poor person in France, so to speak, or in the Congo or Cuba or North Korea. Centrally planned states cannot produce wealth for the poor. There's an index of economic freedom across countries. The top 10 of the top 10 of economic freedom: Hong Kong, Singapore, Australia, New Zealand, Switzerland, Canada, Chile, Mauritius, Denmark, and the United States. The bottom 10 is Iran, Turkmenistan, Equatorial Guinea, Dominican Republic of Congo, Burma, Eritrea, Zimbabwe, Cuba, and North Korea. So those are places I don't want to go. And then we have the per capita income of the top 25%. So that would be annual $36,691. The bottom 25%, $5,188 annual income. So that means Americans are generally 7 times wealthier than these other countries. The bottom 10% income distribution, so that would be $11,382 in economic freedom. The bottom 10%, $1,209 in the central planning model. This is not a theory, this is fact. And then we talk about von Mises. Once you begin to intervene in a market, it creates unintended consequences. I actually think they're intended, by especially the current clowns, but that's just me. The result: further government intervention to try to fix what they perpetrated in the first darn place, ad infinitum. Then the political system is allocating the resources. So when you look at your World War II, the wage and price control, high unemployment and for labor, but the boys got sent overseas, so not enough bodies to fill the demand. The only way to find economic equilibrium is for the price of wages to rise, but the rats did not want that, so they set wage price, which resulted in a shortage of labor. How do we fix shortages of labor? So the idiots came up with the idea of offering health insurance through the employer, so more people would enter the workforce. Many in the manufacturing industry had employer-based health insurance. A third party is paying for your doctor services, and some pay zero for health care. Okay, then we have the price and quantity equilibrium, supply and demand curves. So now when we go to the next phase, when the war is over, in 1954, the IRS rules health insurance is not taxable. Well, that was back then. Marginal tax rate was 91 cents on the dollar. Healthcare insurance became widely available and created an incentive to provide healthcare insurance. More people are demanding this. Supply curve moves to the right and prices rise. Then came Medicare and Medicaid for unemployed and elderly. Then many, many more have employment-based healthcare insurance, and they don't care how much things cost because they are not paying for it or not even aware of the costs. So we have an incentive to produce very expensive healthcare since Medicare is paying for it. Drive up the price of healthcare, so if you buy private insurance on your own, because the insurance companies will have to charge a high premium price for you to buy it from them. So there we go. Or you have no insurance at all. Then when you need health care, they come up with the ACA, and it creates more problems than we started out with. We started with one government intervention with wage and price controls, so we've ended up with government being involved in both health care, employment, and individual choices. The government intervention consequences just keep snowballing each time to bring us to where we are today. The tendency for government to intervene and create further intervention creates a real problem. Yes. The real role of government is whatever it takes to have the market system work. If we want to produce wealth for the masses, we want to have the government set up the rules for the marketplace to work. We must have property rights. Property rights are fundamental in making the market system work. So I know that James Madison would argue that all day long. The role of government is to protect property rights, not what they're doing now, by enforcing contracts, to have the police to make sure that no one's stealing your stuff when you're at work, to have an army to defend the homeland, but not a standing army. Someone needs to make sure that one person's property rights cannot infringe upon someone else's property rights. If a law expands our ability to enjoy property rights, it may be a good law. If it infringes on our property rights, if it makes it harder for us to act according to our own plan, then that law ought not exist. And then they go to the next one. And if anyone wants to talk about that, I got less than 30 minutes. Please call in and talk about these Keynesian things, which is week 7, and it's not as bad as that one because I had several pages. The Keynesianism and also the macroeconomics, they talk about the Great Depression and measuring GDP, and back in that time, Gary was saying for us to talk to anyone who lived through it, which is my mother did live through World War II and the Depression. They had ration coupons, and he said ask them about the ration coupons and how it was to try to obtain normal goods and services. Yeah, Mom talked about that a lot. What got us out of the Depression? Fewer government regulations. Number two, more international trade. Hi, Mackie. Welcome to the party. Three, lower corporate and personal income tax after the war. Let's see. Income, government spending, and lower interest rates. Let's see. In 1936 is when John Maynard Keynes' theory came into this, looking at the economy as a whole. And then we go into what labor is. GDP, the value of all final goods produced within a year. Final goods are consumed by consumers or goods going to be made to make other goods. Intermediate goods, transformed, steel made. I've got to go. My paperwork. And then steel is made into a car. Counting the value of the steel and the car, we double count. Only count final goods. When we hear on the news that the economy grew at 1.2%, that number is that GDP grew by 1.2% final goods. CPI is Consumer Price Index. Now, during a recession, that's a downturn in the economy when GDP goes down for two consecutive quarters. then you have a recession. So recession is two full quarters where GDP fell, accounting for inflation, aggregate demand, and aggregate supply. So this is CPI, Consumer Price Index, and all goods and services, and then aggregate supply curve and aggregate demand. So to try to get to full employment, the quantity equals aggregate of all goods and services and aggregate demand. So first, the good is a consumption good, things we buy that we use up. Second, government spending on goods and services, not including Social Security. If we included that, it would show up in consumption spending when the recipient went out and bought the goods. Three, investment is when companies buy goods that produce other goods, i.e. capital. Exports minus imports. When we talk about investment between what economists talk about investment and what you and we talk about investment in this model, when we buy stock in a company, we think of it as an investment, but the company takes that money and uses it to buy a factory with it or other capital, and that is called an investment. Okay, where are my next ones? Okay, you guys, call in. I'm tired of talking unless you're bored with this. Okay. Consumption demand is income is things that affects what can government do to increase that demand. It can reduce your taxes. Then they have government spending. More aggregate demand moves aggregate demand to the right, moving to full employment. And in World War II, the government provided shovel-ready jobs as well, like they supposedly did with the stimulus. They were trying to get to full employment by pushing the aggregate demand to the right, even though there was nothing being produced. The same with the stimulus package. Investment demand depends on the interest rate. Investment is capital, like new machinery, etc. So interest demand, as interest rates fall, investment demands should go up. If government can make interest rates low, the investment demand will increase. If investment demand increases, the aggregate demand increases. If aggregate demand increases, then we can get ourselves to full employment. Now, the Great Recession, the Federal Reserve lowered the interest rate and it kept it there for years, and at that rate, the idea was that the investment demand would increase and the aggregate would shift to the right. The Keynesian model is that the government can come in and move us towards full employment, like central planners, and it never works. This assumes that the government can solve the information problem. Can't. So how can the government know all the particulars of aggregate quality or quantity, aggregate supply, interest rates, government spending to balance this out? They can't. Milton Friedman said the government most times is going to get these wrong, and they usually do. Okay, can you call in the on the landline or something, I hope. Consumer demand to reduce taxes, increase government demand by government spending. Investment demand, company buying machinery, etc. Government affects interest rate, opportunity cost. Lower the interest rate, the higher the investment demand. Government has fiscal policy and has a monetary policy. The next lecture is going to look at the details as to how the Fed affects that interest rate and the money supply. So that is the lecture 9 is the Austrian business cycle that government causes recessions and not the cure. And the government intervention to try to prevent the recession actually makes things worse, which is true. I think there was one more. So on the discussion board, Keynes economy, some would argue that this is this and central planning is good, but I don't. So anyway, I haven't gotten to week 9 or 10, which are sitting waiting for me, and I have 8. But got about 20 minutes. Call in. love to hear from Lonnie or Bill or Nick or Ron. So just, you know, especially with the things that we're dealing with on the immigration. I got tons of stuff today on immigration. People making phone calls, people emailing their congresspeople trying to say no to this stuff. Nothing should be brought in on the House floor on this stuff. People are talking, they're still talking about the Health Care Act. Do we defund it? Do we repeal it? It's constant insanity with what's going on. So if you guys want to weigh in on that, especially with the demise of the Republic, in my first opening letter that I read from the letters from the Gulag, please call in 646-378-0321. Got a few minutes left, and then we're going to wish everyone a happy Thanksgiving. If you want, I'll just do the first part of this and save the rest, or we'll get through it. This is the monetary theory and the monetary supply. So the question is, what is money? How does the Federal Reserve manipulate interest rates? I think I have Ron. I'll pick him up here. Good evening. How are you?
How are you?
Can you hear me? Okay, I'm trying to hear you.
I guess if I'd plug in all the way, that would work better.
Okay.
I was just chatting with Hollis. He was in the chat room, so.
Great. Oh, good. How's that going?
Well, I think we'll get it worked out one way or another.
Good.
Hopefully.
Yeah.
You know, you're talking about illegal immigration. The one thing I see with the immigration is that it's another tool to drive a huge wedge between our population. Not only just, you know, actual citizens, people here legally,
right.
But there's a lot of illegals here too that are decent members of society, if you will. Not the ones that Bill is talking about, of course.
I know.
That are committing
the LaRosa group.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you know, those people, it's one more
cog in the
cut.
Wheel.
It's like the death of a thousand damn cuts, you know?
Right. And
they're
this
just
is the,
killing us.
That's why we talk about Agenda 21, because we know where this comes from. But when you – just looking at it from purely what's left of the Constitution, a constitutional standpoint, this goes to national sovereignty. And I think we talked about this the other day. You cannot have national sovereignty if you don't have individual sovereignty. We're losing this huge. I think you heard my first thing where we were talking about the death of the Republic and the NDAA and stuff. The thousand cuts, it's more like a million, and we're getting it.
Oh,
it's horrible.
Absolutely. And, you know, the thing is that I think if there was one flaw in our Constitution that stands out glaringly, I think it is the immigration clause. And it was done for the right reasons. It was done to eventually phase out slavery.
Right.
You know, and here we are all these years later. So if we wanted to have a constitutional convention that, you know, would pass an amendment to the Constitution, now that would be an amendment that I could support, returning to the states the ability to admit
yes.
whomever they want.
People.
And then by default, you have to have state citizens, you see.
Right.
And a citizen of one state has the right to travel
sure.
to all the states. And I think that takes it out of the federal government's hands,
yep.
and it leaves it to the determination of the individual states, and we begin to get back state sovereignty.
Right.
Now, of course, there's going to be states like California and others that say, hell yeah, come on in. But I bet that wouldn't last long.
That's correct. Because they're going to be a ghost state soon. They will. It'll be a mess. It's going to look like Rwanda. I mean, that's just my take on it. But No, you're correct. And what Jefferson was talking about when he's talking about the miserable central banks and the Federal Reserve type thing, or he was dealing with the Bank of the U.S. at the time, and then, of course, Hamilton was all for it, you know, little mercantilist dude he was. Jefferson really, really thought that there should have been another amendment to that document because of the central bank situation. He did not like it. He knew where it was going to go, that debt is not good. Debt slaves are not good. So those would be two things we could deal with. Maybe there would be another one. I would like to, since we have such geniuses in our Congress right now, we should have some actual clarification as to what the hell the Commerce Clause was all about. Do you think? I mean, those three items would pretty much tell you what we need to deal with. For openers.
I heard someone the other night, and I don't even remember who it was, talking about the ambiguity in the writing of the Second Amendment. And I thought, okay, only a freaking mind-numbed collectivist.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Could read that very simple
right.
two sentences,
uh-huh.
And come up with the fact that it was ambiguous. It's not ambiguous, but here's the problem for
right.
those idiots that read it and find it to be ambiguous. They have difficulty recognizing that the people are the militia and the people...
Yes.
Are the state. You see,
right.
they see those as three separate entities, the state, the people, and the militia,
uh-huh.
as three totally separate and indifferent and different entities. And I'm sorry, but without the people, the living human beings, there is no damned state. And there's certainly
right.
no damned militia.
And without those gentlemen having their arms at their sides, there would be no country. I mean, we're talking God, guns, and country, that in that order, because that, you know what I'm saying? And I was listening to Dana Lash today on taking over for Glenn's show, because he's doing family stuff, of course. And she had people on there talking about the Second Amendment and these people, the libtards, who were just, I mean, they wet their pants if they see a gun. They don't understand. I guess this was in Texas because they have, you know, open carry long rifles, you know, that kind of stuff. They're so terrified. They equate an inanimate object with Stephen King novels like, you know, The Shining. I mean, these people are nuts. It's just amazing to me. They're not just cognitive dissonance people. They're like Piglosi, who belongs in a rubber room. They know nothing, and they will not educate themselves. They are so terrified. They won't even read words on a page about what a magazine is or anything. I mean, they won't go near it. This is how sick they are.
Oh,
look,
I've seen plenty of people that when they're around a firearm, they get very nervous and twitchy, and they're like, I don't like it. Just get it away from here. It's like, what, the damn thing's not going to jump up and shoot you on its own. It has to be wielded by a person, and then either accidentally through carelessness or negligence or intentionally,
right.
You know, pulling
right.
the trigger, that's when you get shot. Not until.
It's just amazing to me. I mean, there's no other inanimate object that they talk about like this. I mean, the same could be said of a rock or a knife. I've got a chef knife in there that would do some damage, you know, but I just use it to cut my salads and things, you know. It's just, I don't understand this mentality. In fact, my brother-in-law, he saw both my weapons, and he asked me if I had any information on gun safety, and I said, hey, borrow my Taurus book. It's just replete with gun safety, you know, because he doesn't plan on...
information on gun safety. Don't piss me off, and you won't have to worry about it.
No, because he's just being a responsible gun owner, you know, so I let him borrow that, and I said, get out to the range and be careful, point that thing, and always in a safe direction. Never assume it's not loaded, you know.
It's always loaded.
You betcha. Because
there's no question. That's That's why I was so angry.
Unless you dismantle
it. My son shot his damn finger.
I know.
You know, oh. And I told him, his mother didn't understand because I wanted to go punch him in the mouth.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, well, you can't. I said, bull crap. I've taught him better than that.
It's like
the damn
thing's
always loaded, period.
Yeah, if my gun jams or something like that, guess where I'm taking it to? To a gunsmith. I ain't messing with it. No, because I don't know how to do that. I have the instructions, but I've never been taught to dismantle it if I needed to.
It's one thing if it jams, if it misfeeds. You need to be able to clear a misfeed or a jam,
okay.
A stovepipe or whatever. If you get a squib where you've got a round stuck in the barrel,
uh-huh.
that's another story. But
well,
if the gun malfunctions, you need, right,
yeah.
You need to be able to drop the magazine out, rack the slide three or four times while it's pointed
mm-hmm.
downrange, and
right.
see if you can clear the malfunction. It's pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
And I'm certain that you have the ability.
Okay. Well, now that I'm going to the gym and I'm using my tennis ball to strengthen my hands, so, you know, it's funny because I hadn't gone to the range when we were at Delaney and you were showing me the little toys, and I had trouble because I wasn't strong enough, and now I am because I've been going to the range a couple times since then and also doing my weightlifting, and it works. So it's going to be it's a lot easier to handle the slide than the rest of it, so... Yeah.
Well, and they also, for folks that don't have a lot of finger grip, and I have them on one of my pistols,
mm-hmm.
and just because they came with it, not because I needed it, but
right.
it's called a ledge sight.
Huh.
And the rear sight it's made in such a way that it's notched so that you can press it against the corner or edge of a table or a desk or... anything
wow.
like that, and use the rear sight and just with your hand gripping the gun,
mm-hmm.
press down and it will rack the slide.
Cool. Wow.
Yeah, so
that's...
you get a full hand grip instead of trying to grab with a thumb and forefinger.
Right.
It makes it a lot easier for people.
Well, what I've also learned when I've been practicing is, naturally, once you've emptied chambers, et cetera, and you're empty, it just locks open on my
right.
9mm.
And then the lock back on the,
so
the
then I just round. I just press down on the deal, get the empty mag out, put the new one in, and then I press down so that the slide goes back forward, and that baby's ready to go.
Well, you know, there's another way you can do that, because sometimes that slide release can be a real bear.
It can.
You know, I've got a couple that I almost
my Taurus,
can't.
It's different. Yeah. I think
all you've got to
yeah.
do is just pull back on the slide and let it loose, and it'll.
Oh, okay.
It'll
do
the same
it
thing.
By
yep.
itself.
You just,
got it.
Yep. You just reach up and rack the slide a little bit, and it'll go right on by because there's now a magazine in the gun with
sure.
a round in it.
Oh yeah. The I gotta say that Kimber. Oh man.
Kimber makes a decent weapon,
yeah.
but I'll tell you, for the money, and I mean it depends on what model you're looking at. Kimber's, if you're going to get a Kimber, you want the night sights on it, and
okay.
you're going to be $800-$1,000 pretty easily.
Okay.
For my money, if you're going to look at something like the Kimber, I would take the next step up and go with a Dan Wesson. It's just the single
really?
Most accurate 1911 style pistol out there.
Cool.
You can, you know, there's all kinds of Wilson Combat and all these others that you can
uh-huh.
spend $4,000 or $5,000 for a handgun. And if you really do the research, you find out that the Dan Wesson shoots better than every damned one of them.
So this is a Smith and Wesson, or
no the. Dan Wesson is the grandson
oh, okay.
of the Wesson from Smith & Wesson.
Got
Smith
it.
Smith & Wesson hasn't been family-owned in
okay.
a long, long time.
So it's Dan Wesson.
It's a Dan Wesson. And, you know, if you're looking at like a 45, and it just depends
okay.
on what size pistol you want.
Right.
You know, because there's the small ones, which I would not recommend,
right.
especially for a female, because the recoil is going to be a lot stiffer. The heavier
okay.
the pistol, the easier it's going to be to handle as far as the recoil.
Okay.
I've got one, the Dan Wesson Specialist, and I love that gun. I mean,
wow.
Love it.
The reason I liked the Kimber was because it felt lightweight too. Plus, everything on it was easier to work. The release, the trigger pull,
it's a 1911. That's why you're looking at a 1911 Kimber. I guarantee it.
Okay.
And it's probably a Kimber Ultra or a Pro Carry 2, which is an alloy frame.
Yes.
I just sold one of those. Matter of fact, I was talking on the chat that I did three deals in one day and had 235 miles total mileage, and that was one of the guns that I actually sold.
This one was...
I was going to get
so good in my hand.
Oh, huh? Yeah. The 1911, that is the most natural feel for
a handgun.
They're perfection, in my opinion.
What I need to do is just get one of those and keep my Taurus for, you know, already preloaded, so I don't have to, you know, I need a reloading tool and a person. Unbelievable.
9mm is a pain to reload because they're so doggone small, but...
Yeah, I mean...
45, you don't have to worry about it. You shoot them once, maybe twice, they're done.
Oh, that's true. That's true.
They're not
going to
want no more, I promise.
Yeah. They won't be standing. I do have three actual... They're only hold 10 rounds because I'm in California. I've got... I can get them because they actually, in that handbook, gave me the part number, so I can figure out how to get them if I ever get out of state. You know, for more, the 17 rounds magazine editions. But I do have three fully loaded magazines at all times, you know, one in the gun and two extras. Just if I get more of those, it's going to be a lot easier, you know what I mean, to deal with.
Oh, yeah. Well, so, you know, and that is one thing that a lot of guys don't like about the 1911s is you're limited to 7 or 8 rounds in the magazine. Now, I've got an extended mag that'll mm-hmm. hold 10. Looks kind of silly. But honest to God, if you've got a very super accurate 1911 and you're proficient with it, you don't need 10 rounds unless you got 10 bad guys.
Right.
And that's
why
you carry extra mags. And it's not a big deal to do a mag change.
What I need to do is get a strap for my shotgun and carry it on my shoulder. And have the holster and the other stuff. I mean, I don't know what's coming down the pike, but if these guys are talking about it.
Well, if it gets to that, I've got an AR-10. So, you know, I've got 30-round mags for that. And that's lots of 308 fun.
Man, I want to be in your foxhole because this, I don't know. We got to get to Delaney somehow, some way, but... eventually, we want to do the summer again, so that's going to be fun. I'm actually talked to Rod Luke, not in person, but on email today. I guess he was very happy that I was concerned about his loss and, you know, in November and stuff. But he's back. I got about 90 seconds, and you know, we're just everybody just take a deep breath, pray a lot, keep buying your silver and get your money out of the banks and your kids out of the schools. Don't buy insurance. Dump this whole thing. That would be the best thing, to get rid of Obamacare. Nobody do health insurance. Just put your money into a safe and pay the doctor as you go.
Yep.
That's me. Heck with it. Just defund them all.
Look, non-compliance, that's all it takes.
Absolutely.
Somebody called into Levin's show tonight. He said, you know, there's 175 million of us that don't want this thing. If we just simply don't comply, he said, they can't get us all.
I know. Yeah, especially look at how the incompetence just with the website alone. Thank you so much for calling in. I got about 30 seconds. Have a great Thanksgiving. You guys are going to have fabulous food. I know you do. God bless. And to Bill and Ron, Lonnie, Yo, whoever's in there, Nick probably, everybody, have a great one. I've got 10 seconds left. I'm going to see you guys at the other chat room, and it's just going to be a wonderful day, and just have a good one. I don't have a closing song because they're going to cut me off in a second. You guys, be blessed. Love you all.
See ya.
Okay.